I'm Laura Vinroot Poole, and this is What We Wore.
Patty Dubroff is an exceptional makeup artist who works with some of the biggest names in fashion and Hollywood. Her superpower is her ability to make women feel their most beautiful without ever losing the person underneath. You have such an interesting childhood. Will you talk to me a little bit about that, where you're from and what your childhood was like?
Oh, wow. Well, I was born in Germany, and then my father's American, my mother's German, and then we moved to the States because my father left his post in Germany. He was in the military. And I grew up in New Jersey, and I grew up like in a kind of a small town in northern New Jersey. But I was close enough to New York City where I knew that it was right there, just right there, an arm's length away. I had relatives in Long Island, and we would go to see them very often. So we would drive from Jersey to Long Island, always passing like that, you know, cityscape, and then passing. Yeah. And so I was always like, you over there. I'm coming for you as soon as I can. And I moved to New York the second I graduated high school. But I was thinking about, you know, that this is a very, you know, the people that you talk to are fashion people. And I haven't considered myself a fashion person.
Really?
For a really long time. Well, I don't know. I guess just because, you know, beauty's over here, fashion's here. Yes, they intersect, but maybe because of the Hollywood thing, you know, in the mix.
Yeah.
I was thinking about like my beginnings and I really like started in fashion in so many ways. Even in high school, I was part of a program called DECA, Distributive Education Clubs of America or something. I mean, I might be getting that wrong. My notes are somewhere else. But what it was like, you know, I was studying like marketing. Like in high school, I was studying like marketing, fashion focused marketing, sales, not design per se, but marketing and sales for fashion purposes. And I would do school half a day, and I would work the other half a day as part of this work study DECA program. Wow. So that was the part that I really was like into, because I wanted to get started with life as soon as possible. And getting started with life for me meant like getting to work. I was working in a clothing store in a mall, and it was a store called Inwear Matinique, which was a Copenhagen Danish fashion brand where this is the 80s, parachute pants were really a thing, and oversized suits, you know, like talking head style, big shoulder suits. And I worked in that store. And then when I moved to New York, I was pursuing makeup. I moved to New York straight after high school. I was pursuing makeup, but I didn't really yet know how to do that, except for, you know, the obvious department store counter. I had a couple of retail fashion jobs. I worked at Trash and Vaudeville on St. Mark's Place.
Yep.
And the thing about Trash and Vaudeville is they really liked me, but I didn't look tough enough, like hardcore punk enough to be on the sales floor. So I got to work with the team. The owners owned a clothing company called Trip, New York City. Mm-hmm. And it was making all this like stretchy black and like black tight jeans and stretchy, like black, like the stuff that would sell in Trash and Vaudeville. I went and worked in their kind of manufacturing loft space. Huh. And I would remember like cutting patterns and cutting fabric and, you know, doing like whatever they needed me to do, because I was part of the Trash and Vaudeville family. But yeah, again, they had me out there in like the, you know, where the clothes were being made.
Huh.
And then I had a stint working at Fiorucci, and then doing makeup, of course. Yeah.
What was your first makeup memory as a child?
I have this very clear vision of myself sitting in front of my mother's makeup mirror as a child and being surrounded by the things. And I, you know, I've always thought that memory was like 10 years old, but I'm realizing it's a little bit earlier. It's more like 7 or 8. And her makeup mirror surrounded by her things. She had nice things, but she wasn't a great you know, beauty, but she had like some decent things. And she would let me hang out there when she went to work, as long as I didn't make a mess. And so I remember, you know, playing with those magical potions and lotions and powders and having this distinct thought, like, this is what I want to do when I grow up.
And how did you know that it was a thing? I mean, how did you?
I didn't. Yeah. I didn't. There was like back then, I mean, we're talking now the 70s. Mm-hmm. There was no known career as a makeup artist. A makeup counter was obvious. And then maybe if you put the pieces together, you could see people on a screen, you know, TV, you know, Gilligan's Island, someone must have been doing Ginger's makeup or whatever.
Wait, so you really recognize that was a thing, that somebody, that was a job?
No, I didn't recognize the TV and the movie makeup artist part. I didn't get that. Like it wasn't in my awareness, but I recognized the makeup counter part. Because I would go to the counter with my mother. So that's why straight from high school, I was like, oh, I'm going to work at a department store in New York City at a makeup counter, because that's how you do makeup.
And it was more about learning the technique or having the tools to be able to do that and make people feel better. Like what was the...
All the things. Yeah. All those things. I mean, I think it's very close to sales, right? It's making people feel seen. Making people feel comfortable, making people feel like you're guiding them in the right direction to be their most kind of empowered and beautiful. So whether you're doing that, helping someone to kind of do that through clothing or through what's on their face, very, very similar, ultimately with the goal of selling, obviously, when you're in those environments. But, you know, with the kind of the maybe the heart space goal of, you know, helping this person feel great.
Were you doing it with your friends at all? And what were you doing with your makeup at that time?
Yeah, prior to leaving high school, during middle school and high school, I was the girl who was getting everyone ready for all the plays, all the dances, everything, every weekend. We, you know, that's where the party happened. That's where the real fun happened.
So true. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think about that a lot. I'm like, the best part of the night was always like the girls getting ready together.
It still is, actually.
and it really can be. Even, you know, even now I'm getting people ready to go to big high profile events, but I bet if you ask them what was the best part of the night, they might say, you know, hanging with the glam squad.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Trash and Vaudeville and Fiorucci, and then how did you get a job at a department store doing makeup?
I did. Well, the first one was Bloomingdale's, but I got a job spraying perfume. And that was like, I did that literally, I think it was a couple of days, and I had such a headache. And I was like, no, this isn't right. I went over to Bergdorf Goodman, and that looked really fancy and pretty.
Yeah.
And again, this is like 1987. I told them that I had experience doing makeup, and I believed it. and I don't think they had any way of proving it or not.
Do you have to show them a face, you know, anything like that? No. No, you were just like, yeah, I've been doing it for years.
Yeah. And then I just got a job at a counter. And then the counter trained me.
What was the counter, Patty?
At that time, Yves Saint Laurent. I think you would call it something different now. And I remember being right across from the Chanel counter, and I was friends with the girls at the Chanel counter. And I was trained, you know, through the brand very much, you know, the brand will give you like, you know, the brands still do that. They give like in-house training on their kind of specific techniques and products. And that was the first way that I was actually really learning about makeup. Because there was no YouTube, there was no, you know, yeah, there was none of that. And then that opened my eyes to, okay, I'm doing makeup like this, but then I'm in New York and I'm starting to see and meet people and see like, oh, I could be doing it for photo shoots. And there's music videos. It was the time of MTV. And then I got a job at MTV working at the, in the studios as a freelancer. And again, this is the time where MTV was like the center of the universe.
Yeah.
I would do like the VJs and the guests that would come in. I was just there, you know, for whoever needed. And then a show called House of Style with Cindy Crawford began. And I was able to work with Cindy on that show. And, you know, that was like one of my first things.
From Yves Saint Laurent at Bergdorf and like understanding, I mean, they're like your paints. I mean, I guess they're your, those mm-hmm. are your, that's your medium. That's your, those are your tools. Have you already formed your ethos, I guess, of like what it was you wanted women to feel like, or what it was that you believed about makeup, or what it should be doing for women?
I am not going to lie and say I had an ethos when I was 18 or 19. I was literally just like hustling and probably paint, like the more was better probably back then. Like yeah. the more product you could pack on someone, or the more things you could encourage them to need in their life. Yeah, I had no ethos. I mean, I was just hustling. But I loved makeup. And I had a real passion and a real like intuitive joy, intuitive spark for it.
From working with clients and learning sort of the trade, I guess, and then moving to Cindy Crawford, I mean, that's like the beginning of the supers. Like that's such a huge time. Did you understand something new about makeup when you connected with her and you connected with House of Style?
You know, the supers were a big part of my life, because then I was also assisting some of the great makeup artists at the time, and especially Francois Nars. And so the supers were the girls that I kind of was spending a lot of time with.
And you were the same age.
And we're all the same age.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an assistant, but they're very well known, but yeah. we're all the same age. They taught me a lot about me. You know, they taught me, I mean, obviously the people I was being mentored by, Francois Nars, I assisted Bobby Brown, I assisted Kevin Aquan, Mary Greenwell.
Susan Hauser.
How did you know? Did I tell you that? Or did we connect over that?
Research, Patty.
Oh, wow. Yeah. She was my first. Wow, Susan. They definitely helped inform me, you know, and teach me. It was almost like I see myself as like this wild, like rider of a horse. Like I could get on a horse and I could ride bareback, and any horse I'll jump on and woo. But then they taught me how to refine it and maybe ride, you know, with a more finesse.
Looking back, like working with Susan Hauser or Bobby Brown, were they training you from just showing you how they did it? Or were they actually telling you in words, here is what we're doing, here is what, how I want the client to feel? Or, you know, I mean, how does that work?
Well, I think back then, because we were working with models, nobody really cared about what the client was feeling, because the client, the client is a model and the model is just a canvas. The feeling was what was to be evoked either on a runway or, you know, in a photo shoot.
And is the client the designer or Vogue or right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The client is either, you know, exactly the designer or Irving Penn, because you're in his studio, whatever. So yes, a combination of words, but it was very much by observation, I think, mostly. Mm-hmm. I think that most of my learning was by watching and then mimicking and then finding my own way of doing things. Studying through my eyes and then, you know, recreating it, not necessarily words.
Talk a little bit about, if you will, about Susan Hauser and how she helped propel your career.
Wow, that's such an amazing memory. Like she was really the first person I assisted. I don't even remember how we met. I wish I would have asked her. I wish I would have checked in with her to ask her. But I remember that she was doing a lot of these like really big fashion shows, but for these trade environments. And she took me on my very first work trip to Las Vegas. And we just had to keep painting people at this trade show. And she was like a mom, because I had never, like, I traveled as a kid with my parents, but I had never gone anywhere by myself for work. And so there I was like traveling for work and not having any clue. She was just really like this perfect maternal, sweet, but she wasn't old enough to be my mom, but she like assumed this role because I was just like, I knew nothing. Yeah, I don't remember anything other. I don't remember any other specific kind of things she taught me other than just how to be, you know, in those very early days.
And then what about working with Francois Nars?
Francois, I was with him for like a year and a half as his first assistant. And this was at a time where he was the guy who was doing all the fashion, you know, Versace, Calvin, Valentino, Prada. I mean, you name it, Alberto Ferretti. I mean, Marc Jacobs. No, even before Marc Jacobs, maybe it was whatever. Anna Sui. So it was like New York, Milan, Paris. And me being his first assistant, man, I traveled with him all the time, you know. Yeah. So, you know, we'd be in Milan doing like all the shows, and then we'd hop on a plane and we'd go to Paris and we'd do shows. And it was supermodel time. And then when we weren't in the show cycle, he was not working with Steven Meisel at that time. He was working with everyone else. Him and Steven had kind of stopped. So I got to experience Francois in the studio with Irving Penn, Avedon. One day it's Ellen Van Unworth. One day we're shooting a Madonna video. Then we're working with Peter Lindbergh. Then we're working with Demarché.
Wow.
That was my kind of learning. That was my training ground.
Yeah.
And it was every day that I was with him, you know, and that's where I learned everything. And that's where I met the people who then gave me a chance to begin my career as me. Yeah, that was a big thing.
Did he ever give you any advice?
I mean, he gave me advice all the time because, you know, I was like having to kind of like do for him, whether it was, you know, where to set up the makeup, you know, like, no, oh no, don't set up at that table where they have those lights, you know, that makeup light. No, no, no. Go to the window, go to a door, set up over there, find a table. We're working in natural light. So that was the first thing. Immediately, like where to set up was not where they necessarily wanted you to set up. Of course, unless you were in Irving Penn's studio and then you set up where you set up, where they wanted you to set up. But that was but for the most part, we were going to a window, going to a door, getting to the natural light, making everyone figure it out, because that was what was most important, is that we had good light. He was very much a minimalist. He wasn't a maximalist. And so his makeup kit would have very few things in it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it wasn't a big thing. And I remember one time it was a box, you know, one of these little boxes. And I remember one time we got to set in the box. I don't know what had happened in the night before, but nothing was left in the box. It was like he'd taken everything out and left five things inside the box. And I was a bit like, where's all the stuff? And he was like, it's okay. We do it. And we did an entire face with a concealer, a brown pencil, a lip balm. I feel like that was it. You know, it was like one of these things. It was crazy, but it showed me that with those things, you could do everything. Because that brown pencil could be a lip liner and could be a brow if you blend it well. And your eye, obviously.
Yeah.
And even you could use it in here if you want. And that concealer could be blended with the lip balm, could be some lipstick for a pale lip. And, you know, obviously to clean the skin. And like, voila. So that was a big lesson. So, you know, I'm really grateful that I didn't come from the school of like 12 suitcases.
Yeah. And tell me about Bobby Brown.
Yeah, Bobby, it was very brief because I think I just did like one or two shows with her, and it was very early. And I think maybe, I mean, her line had launched, lipsticks had been launched, and I don't remember more than like, it was like one or two shows, and she was, you know, a great cheerleader.
That was a really revolutionary new way of looking at makeup, wasn't it?
Very much so. And her, like her lipstick line. Well, what year did the lipstick line launch? I feel like there was an overlap with me being at Bergdorf's, but I might be like mixing up timelines because I just loved Bergdorf's so much. I would spend time there all the time.
I would move in if I could.
I also had like, because I was a hustler, I didn't have just one job ever. I was also working doing the windows at Bergdorf's.
Oh, wow.
So like I would do makeup in the day and then I would join the window team at night when the windows had to be changed over.
That's incredible.
It was incredible. Yeah.
Patty, well, speaking of that golden age, what was it like working in the 90s with the supermodels as your peers?
I knew it was special. And they were very, you know, they were very famous in that world. But it was also kind of weirdly normal. That was just where I landed. And these were the girls that were my age. And we would, like, you know, do these shows, and then we would go
hang out.
And
yeah.
hang out. And, you know, sometimes we'd just hang out in their hotel room because it was a bother to be out and there'd be people, too many people. But, you know, this is all pre cell phones and, you know, everything being deeply documented. So I am so grateful that there are not photos of some of the, you know, shenanigans. But those girls, you know, I think I gravitated towards the ones that were more grounded in that very ungrounded world. So Christy Turlington was, you know, Christy and I became really close, I think, because I know because we shared not only a love of, like, the whole fashion thing that we were in the swirl of, but a deep commitment to spiritual life.
And you all went to India together.
We went to India together, and we would travel together. And it was, there was, like, you know, we would travel together for spiritual retreats and things like that. Yeah. So that's where, you know, I saw, like, oh, okay, you can be in the midst of all of this, but you can still keep a focus on what's really important, you know, if you find the right people.
Yeah.
Find your tribe.
That's sort of when the changeover over to actresses happened. We interviewed Ivan Shaw about the 90s and sort of how that trickled in. Did you notice it at the time, and did it interest you?
Well, I really noticed it because I was living in New York, and my boyfriend, fiance, now husband, is in Los Angeles. And so I was really teetering between, like, do I go to LA to be with him and to have this life, or do I stay in New York? And I was very adamant to stay in New York and be a fashion person, because LA, it was a little bit lame. And then as I was shooting, like, covers for all the magazines, you know, doing all the editorial, but mainly the covers, it was becoming less and less models that were being booked, and it was actors, and it was Liv Tyler. And then it was, like, you know, young actors. And I had, and this is, like, the very late 90s, before 2000, you know, more like 99. I remember, like, 99, 2000, really noticing it, like, oh, I'm working with actresses now, no more models. And why don't I do that there? And so I decided to move to Los Angeles because I saw that it was becoming cool to work with actresses and in the fashion realm.
Which was really revolutionary. I mean, that was not a thing. And so what did all the supers do? They were doing shows and advertising?
I guess, you know, the advertising. I mean, supers are always going to do advertising.
That's always the point.
Yeah, but I mean, even now, more and more actresses get those campaigns. So, yeah, I guess it was just, there was just maybe there was, like, the supers were the uber famous anyway. Maybe it was just more like the ground of the kind of newer ones, or, you know, kind of not the top were being more affected. But I just remember, for me, it was like, oh, why not be in Hollywood where these women live if I'm going to be working with these women anyway?
Will you describe the plane ride to LA after making the decision?
So I made the decision. It was, well, September, we made the decision to move, and then September 11th happened. And so then we were planning to move a few months after September, like January. And that was hard because being, you know, in the city where the city's smoking and burning and all of that feeling, but we decided, okay, we're still going to move. There was a moment where we're like, maybe we should stay and support our city. We make the move, and I'm on the plane. I'm on the plane to LA for my move, and I land, and there's a message to call my agent. And I get on the phone with him. I'm at baggage carousel. Okay. And he's like, well, guess what? You just booked the Vanity Fair Hollywood cover with Annie Leibovitz shooting. And I had never shot a Vanity Fair cover before. I'd shot pictures for the inside. I'd never worked with Annie before. And, you know, it was one of those Hollywood covers where, you know, there was multiple talent.
Right, right.
And I think that like two of the girls had asked for me. So that's why it was, it brought me in. At that moment, I was just like, holy shit.
Yeah.
This is, yes. And there was this like, thank you, like above God, however we express God. Because I knew like, this is a sign I've made the right decision. It was so strong.
Do you remember who was on that cover?
I do. Jennifer Connelly, Kirsten Dunst, Naomi Watts. Gosh, I'm remembering that panel. There were three panels. I don't remember all the panels, but I remember that it was like one of the more casual than, you know, Hollywood covers where they're in jeans and tank tops. The girls are all young, very fresh face. And I shared the cover with, Paul Starr, who was a big deal makeup artist in LA. I mean, the fact that I was like sharing credits with Paul Starr was such a big deal. So that was meeting Annie, and she really liked me off that shoot. And then she booked me for an American Vogue cover with Angelina Jolie.
Wow.
Like right after that. And then she booked me with another Vogue cover with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Renee Zellweger for the Chicago movie. And it just happened that I was working with both of those ladies. So then I got another Vogue cover. And then I continued to do those Vanity Fair Hollywood covers for years and years after that.
Are you pregnant at this time or do you have a baby?
Not when I first moved. I moved in, I guess it was 2002 I got here. I gave birth to her a year later. So yeah, there is a photo of me working on the second Vanity Fair, the second for me Vanity Fair Hollywood cover, where I'm holding Bianca because she came to set, and Gwyneth, I think, is meeting her, and Gwyneth was pregnant.
Did you feel like that was easier to manage in LA than would have been in New York?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just winter, just even the winter, getting through the winters.
So when this happens and all of this sort of cements, is that when you felt like your style, I guess, as an artist really emerged as a thing, the Patti Dubroff face?
I wouldn't have acknowledged it then. Like I'd say 23 years ago, I wouldn't have called it a thing. I think maybe now I've come to realize that there's a clear aesthetic. You know, maybe 10 years ago, I probably paid attention to that also and noticed that a little bit, but I wasn't coming into Hollywood being like, I've got this thing and you all want it, you know, like,
but looking back, you did. I mean, like I think that's one of the most interesting things on social media when you post past covers that you've done, you're like, oh, that really was like so different for the time. I think
it's true. I mean, I have been pulling up some of those old covers and I realized like, oh, I was always brought in to do that thing, which was to underdo when things were being overdone. Underdoing, I guess, has always been kind of my sweet spot.
Yeah. Do you think that's still what your style is now?
Yeah. I even if I tried, I wouldn't be able to pack a ton of products on someone's face. Like it just, I wouldn't be able to do it. Like I have to get pushed really hard to go harder. You know, I can make a statement, but I'm like, I can't lose the person.
So then you're in LA and then you're starting to do red carpet. I mean, that's a totally different thing. Who had told you what it needs to look like or what?
No one. As you're saying that, I realized like that was not something that someone, you know, mentored me into, you know, like because and doing red carpet is like it is its own thing. Like,
yeah.
And I think the thing that helped me to be able to do red carpet in the way that's needed, which is basically you need to be a retoucher with makeup,
right?
Because there is no retoucher involved. And I think that that's coming from an earlier generation of not shooting digital and having the face needed to be as perfect as possible, because retouching wasn't even part of the conversation. So coming from that, but also because I had also kind of come from like this Peter Lindbergh school of, you know, no, you don't put a lot, you don't hide the person, you don't make it too perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You always leave, you know, kind of this kind of feeling of skin and realness to it. So merging those two things is, how are you a perfectionist retoucher without packing on a ton of product and keeping this like kind of like feeling of realness and the person? And so I had to figure out how to mend those two worlds to then put it on a red carpet and make sure that it looked great at noon and then at midnight, you know, in the 12-hour span.
And did it always work?
Not always. No. there's some doozies. I like have come across some doozies in trying to do a thing.
That's a question I have. Is doing a thing, is it from the client saying, I really want, you know, smoky eyes? And you're like, you really shouldn't be doing smoky eyes because it has to be from, what, you know, whatever.
Both. There could be that, like, you know, that's the thing the client wanted and it didn't hold up, or I, you know, I misstepped, and, you know, maybe I also realized that I would take some kind of editorial tricks and apply them to a red carpet and then see like, oh, that doesn't really work because it doesn't help. Then things don't stick around or stay put as long. Like, for instance, one is like, you know, an editorial trick is to like grease the eyelid, you know, and for the camera, that really helps bring a lot of light to the eye. And even if you're doing something very dark, if you grease that lid, there's some light play within the darkness. That's great. That's great. You can control it. You're there touching up all day on set. But then I did that on a red carpet. Cool. We're going to do something really dark, but I'll grease it up so it look, you know, more destroyed. It just looked like a hot mess by the time, like, you know.
Like wet tar.
Wet tar that had slid, you know. Exactly. You know, and I also like have learned that, you know, I have a comfort zone, and if I go out of that comfort zone, maybe it doesn't always go so well, like false lashes.
Yeah.
But even me, like applying them, it's like, I've got good days, but it's not my comfort zone.
Do you remember the first red carpet that you did?
The first like meaningful red carpet was, I mean, it's not the first one because I'm sure I had done some to get them ready for like premieres, but I didn't really understand. Like I was still like, I hadn't really understood like that they, what they were going to do. But I remember Liv Tyler, the Oscars, 1999, she's wearing like a lavender Prada.
Yes.
She has really short hair. That was my first like Oscars red carpet. That was like, that was a big deal.
Were you nervous?
I, you know, it felt like it was doing something very extra and special, and I was nervous. Yeah.
Yeah. But you knocked it out of the park.
She looked gorgeous. Maybe I could have powdered a little bit more, you know, in the right places, because, you know, powder's like, you don't want to overdo it, but if you underdo it, it can be a little glowy.
Are you a critic of your work? I mean, do you go back and say like, oh, I could have done this?
Oh my God. Yeah.
Really?
I mean, don't we all? Right.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't know that we all do. I think we probably should to a point, because I think that's how you learn. And I think a lot of people aren't willing to learn. I mean, I wonder if some of your mentors, I wonder if Francois ever did that.
I can't remember hearing him criticize his work. I don't know. I mean, but maybe those are also some of the things that people don't say out loud.
Yeah.
You know, what's going, you know, what are you saying in your head?
Was there a difference in working with actors and, you know, them wanting to stay closer to what the box that they thought that they were in, or how they should be portrayed, or how they should look?
The supermodels very often had a point of view, and they weren't, you know, that when they were the super supers, they dictated, you know, even if the show look was this,
yeah,
within this, they are going to.
Linda said, but actually it's going to be this.
Right. But actually it's going to be this. You can do a little bit of that, but it's going to be this.
That's funny.
So I saw that in play. So I understood, you know, how to, and also coming from retail, how to make that person, you know, that person needs to be, their input is super important. So then, yes, when working with actresses, but I realized like, no, this is really about making sure that they feel like the best version of themselves. They are not in some character right now. They are not, you know, putting on some kind of crazy outfit that is for a photo shoot that's not who they are. They are who they are. They need to feel good. This is a collaboration. And I realized that that was like what was really resonating for me as an artist anyway. I wasn't like in the fashion world. I wasn't good at creating like all the circus stuff,
Right, right.
you know, Pat came around and blew all our minds by this kind of fantasy world that she would create. No idea how to do that.
Yeah.
Like, it was not my, you know, my thing at all. My thing is put me with someone and I will help bring out her ideal version of herself for that moment. And considering all of the input, you know, involved.
But I think that's your superpower. And I think it's interesting that when your career really shot up, I think was when you got to Los Angeles, because you're working with all of these people that you are making them feel that way, but also paparazzi's catching them the next day with no makeup on. So it's also not too far from the real version.
Yeah, it's like it's not too far from the real version, but it's a heightened version of the real version.
And you also, I mean, people are devoted to you. And I think that that says everything about, well, it's who you are as a person, but I also think it is what you create, because I think you just make people feel so good.
Thank you.
You show them their beauty almost, I think.
Thank you. That's really sweet.
Have you ever looked back and realized how physically exhausting what you do is?
Oh, absolutely. I don't have to look back. I guess when I was younger, I just powered through it. But I've had flashes of me like in my makeup kit in the subway in New York. And I'm like, how the hell did I do that?
Exactly.
You know, like I have all these physical things that I'm, you know, trying to keep in check now. And a lot of it is because of my kind of years and years of stance in a certain way. When you're reaching like this and, you know,
Yeah.
it can throw things out. But being a makeup artist is a physically challenging job. And that's why so many people will have assistance with them to handle the physically challenging stuff. I'm not that girl to like have someone around me all the time. I like to have assistance and I like to be a mentor, but I also am very respectful of the person who, again, whose makeup I'm doing. And it's their space. It's not my space. It's their space. So is it appropriate for me to bring another person into their space? Because if that's not appropriate, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to open my bag myself and put my stuff on the table and pack it up myself.
Do you think that's just who you are as a person? Is that how you grew up, or is that something you think that you learned from mentors?
I think it's a combo of all those things. And it's a combo of like also being sensitive because I see like, you know, when I get into a room and, you know, there's all maybe someone, a hairdresser has assistants. And so all of a sudden that person who, you know, we're to work on has to put these extra guards up. And I'm just really sensitive to the guards.
You are so intuitive and so spiritual. I mean, that's a big part of your work, I think, don't you think?
It is, and I've only come to realize that very clearly the past couple of years. Because before, I had two different channels going on. I had my spiritual world over here, and I would like go, you know, tap into my spiritual world. But then I would go back to work, and that was this line over here, and they were kind of running side by side, and I would flip flap back and forth. But then I started to realize, no, everything is one, and I can't separate this out. So I have to, you know, I have to keep this like in this one thing. And what that can mean is, in like the kind of a more negative sense, if you're very sensitive, you take on a lot, you know, of other people's
Yeah, stuff.
stuff. And so sometimes I would go home from work and I would like pass out for 3 days
Yeah.
and feel like completely drained and sick and not understand why I couldn't get off the couch for 3 days, you know, after being on a job with so and so. Other times I would, you know, kind of come out of a job and I would feel so high and so much energy that I couldn't sleep for 3 days. Why was that? Because I was taking on this a whole other thing, you know. So the more I've learned to like contain myself, protect myself,
Yeah.
be really clear with myself. I'm not taking on anybody else's stuff. I'm gonna leave it, you know, leave it at the door.
Do you relate to your work more as a career or as a calling?
I mean, it's definitely both because it's, you know, gives me a roof over my head and food on, you know, food on the table. And I knew as a little girl that I was obsessed with these magical powders and potions and things and the transformational, you know, quality and transformational potential that they had. So it was both. Yeah, for sure. I know that I'm very, very fortunate that I am, like, you know, doing the thing that I love as a child and have made a career out of it. I know it's so rare.
It's rare.
So rare.
You changed my perspective recently in such a big way. I told you that I was kind of over makeup. I just was like, you know what? I've given up. I'm not doing it. And I thought, you know, we were hiking together and I thought you were going to be like, yeah, makes sense. Or like, me too. And you said, it really doesn't take a lot, you know, like you shouldn't give up and it really doesn't take a lot. And one of the things you said about it was that it makes people uncomfortable around you when you're not showing up as your best self. Well, first, I love the idea of showing respect to the people that you're around. And I thought about it and I was like, I have this friend who like always wore makeup and now just like doesn't. And it really is uncomfortable being around her because you feel like she's sick or something. Like, you're like, is there, how can I help support you? Like, what's going on? You know, it's a real mirror to her insides. Can you give a few little tips on what that means, just to do a little bit?
That realization really came about when I was starting to see how something so superficial, like makeup, clothing,
yeah,
too,
clothing. I mean, yeah,
same superficial, how these superficial things can actually be very, very kind of spiritually charged.
Yes.
Totems, really. And what it was I was teaching people to do makeup. And I was in this kind of period where I was doing a lot of teaching. And a lot of people would come to me and be like, I don't want to do it. I don't care. Blah, blah, blah. And I really saw very clearly that them not caring or not wanting to make that extra step made all the people around them that they had to work with and engage with uncomfortable, because if they looked kind of pale and kind of washed out and kind of meek and whatever, it made the other people feel concerned.
Yeah.
And you don't want to step into a circle of people or a meeting or a group or whatever, and all of a sudden everyone focuses on you and is worried, or it's like it twists it.
It's like you didn't show up.
No. And you say, so what you want is like to step into that room and show up in a way where everyone is kind of like, oh, she's here, or yeah, or not even like, just like, it's like a smile, an inner smile comes to play.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take that much to have that effect on your environment. But what it does take is meeting yourself in the mirror.
Yeah.
And having to make the time and put the effort in. And when you meet yourself in the mirror, that's where the real magic can happen. Because when we meet ourselves in the mirror, if we're doing it in a way where like, oh, I don't want to be doing this, or I don't like what I see, it's a spiral. It's a downward spiral. And if you can meet yourself in the mirror and even for 1 minute be like, hi, yeah, I know I'm older, but I still love you, or, you know, whatever. Just tricks of the mind. It lifts you up. And then ultimately you're lifting up your entire environment. I could go on and on and on talking about that stuff. That aspect of beauty, because that's a, like, hold this spot, you know, check back later. You'll see what I'm working on kind of vibe.
I cannot wait to hear your answer. What did you wear to the prom? and what was your makeup like, for sure?
Oh, the makeup was so much. Well, I had, okay, so I'm going to set the scene. It's 1986.
Nice.
Or 85, 86. I had gone to a Duran Duran concert at Madison Square Garden. And I met a boy who looked exactly like John Taylor.
Amazing.
The hair, the dress. He was kind of walking around, like, kind of like he knew that he looked like John Taylor. And all the girls were like, ah. I was very dressed and he was very dressed and we connected and we became friends. And I asked if he would be my prom date. And he was very gay and he loved that idea. And so I had this like crazy hot kind of, you know, John Taylor lookalike guy as my date. And then for the prom outfit, I went to a vintage store in New Jersey, somewhere like in the next couple towns over. And I found a emerald green satin dress from the 50s that fit me like a glove and had a matching pair of shoes, which was bizarre. They were like pumps. And they fit me. I remember in that store, in that little weird little antique vintage store, this green dress and the shoe. And I'm like, no. And then it was like, it was made for me. It was like, it was very 50s cut. So it was tight at the bodice and it had a little flare and it was below the knee.
Strapless?
And no, it had some little straps.
Okay.
I'm going to see if I can find a picture. But my hair at the time, it was short and bleached bottle blonde like Madonna.
Okay.
Like I was kind of doing the like Madonna wannabe thing. So I accessorized with a lot of Madonna-ish
bracelet
stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of makeup on. So much makeup. I might have even put a mole because I'm like, oh, this is so vintage, you know, let's do that.
And he showed up.
And he showed up dressed to the nines as if like he was, you know, in Duran Duran. I hope I can find a picture.
You can. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Beauty.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.